Good morning. The divisions between supporters and opponents of the 30-meter telescope are growing deeper. For some, preventing its construction is the cause of their lives. But is there more to the opposition than we're hearing? Today we'll talk with Shelley Munioka of the community group Kahea. It's Thursday, April 16th, day two of Challenge 2015. This is The Conversation.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk. This morning we'll hear music you're unlikely to have ever heard before, the music of the Himalayas. And we'll look ahead to an Earth Day mystic dance ritual on Maui.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and all The Conversation starts now, well, right after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann, and happy National Harmonica Day.
Oh, is that what explains that music? Okay, now I get
it. I'd be wondering.
Well, good morning and happy National Harmonica Day to you too.
It's going to be a good one.
Well, we'll see about that. It's yet to unfold, but it has all the makings of a very good thing around here for day two of Challenge 2015. But for now, we're going to have a good conversation, we hope. Now, over the last month, the divide between supporters and opponents of the 30-meter telescope has grown deeper. The message from protesters, many of them young, is that building the project would continue to violate a sacred place. Let's try that again. Some also want all the current telescopes removed, but one group says there's more to the conversation than the polarized perspectives. Kahea is a community-based organization promoting the quality of life in Hawaii through cultural understanding and environmental justice. Shelley Munioka is joining us now from Kahea, and thank you for being here in the studio.
Thank you so much for having me.
There has been some criticism that we aren't really hearing a lot of clarity from both sides because this is such an emotional issue. What do you think it's being left out of the conversation that we're hearing, which seems to be so much drawn into polarized opposites?
I do want to say that I think the emotional issue, it's an important facet to understand because it's really what roots people and really where the commitment comes from. So, you know, not to understate the importance of those. I think the piece that's kind of been left out has really kind of been the well-documented history of UH and DLNR's failure to really protect Mauna Kea. So whether or not you see it as a sacred place or simply a special place, I think most people can agree that it deserves special protections, or at least that's what the law says, because it's classified as a conservation district. So there are special protections in place that have not been upheld. And I think that's the piece that's really kind of been missing.
Specifically, what hasn't been upheld?
So, for example, in order to build in a conservation district, you need to get a construction permit, and there's 8 criteria that must be met, and there's just simply no way that these projects could meet those. So, for example, you know that it can't cause substantial adverse harm to the natural and cultural resources of the area, but there's been previous studies that have that precise language, including the TMT's own environmental impact statement, that the cumulative impact of those telescopes has been significant, substantial, and adverse. So it kind of begs the question that how are we continuing to put more and more of these structures on that mountain? There's also, in terms of, poor management, it's been well documented. There's been audits, particularly the 1998 audit cited, you know, that historic preservation has been neglected, that the first 3 telescopes were built without any permits at all, that were given retroactively without any kind of fine or penalty, that there's been other instances of violations of unpermitted structures being put up, fines being levied and then never collected. There's been historic sites damaged. There's been recorded mercury spills. There's a lot of things that have happened on that mountain that have been well documented and kind of beg the question as to why UH is still continuing being allowed to have free reign on the mountain.
How do you answer that question?
I really don't know, you know, and as we try and kind of crunch the numbers around the money, for instance, it's kind of baffling because UH pays $1 a year for their lease from DLNR, and then they sublease to other telescope operators, so these are countries and universities, for $1 a year, or in many cases for nothing at all, no money, and in exchange they're getting telescope viewing time, which is by some estimates valued. We did one cost analysis at $80,000 a night is what they're charging to folks, not the university. So the university is getting that benefit of being able to use all these telescopes for free. So, you know, as far as we can tell, that's the clear motive and benefit for UH. I don't really know why DLNR hasn't been better at enforcing the rules that are supposed to be upheld. I mean, they say, you know, they're understaffed, they don't have enough money or resources to do the proper management. And so over the years, more and more of that management authority has been ceded to UH, which is really problematic because they're the primary developer of that mountain. So I can't really speak to why, but only that that's been a long trend.
When you look at it from the perspective of the project itself, mm-hmm. I mean, just the TMT project, mm-hmm. according to the TMT community affairs manager, they've been out in the community for 7 years and mm-hmm. they're feeling very baffled that mm-hmm. they're just now getting this kind of reaction. Mm-hmm. What do you make of that?
To me, the length of the process is not particularly significant because all through those 7 years, there has been opposition. And it's well documented in all of the like kind of formal public hearings. There's plenty of testimony in opposition to the project. Not to disagree with the fact that suddenly there's a very different kind of opposition. And I think, you know, in terms of why we see that now, certainly the arrests were the point that kind of inflamed this. And I think people really seeing people's commitment to this issue and how much it means and matters to them, excited other people and inspired people to come out and show their commitment as well.
What do you think is different about the opposition now than what you say has been happening over 7 years?
So traditionally, the opposition has really been one in procedural and legal hearings. So really arguing and countering, every point put forth by UH and TMT, which, you know, is no small feat. UH, you know, has spent almost $4 million on this case alone. And these are, you know, community folks that have consistently, you know, come out that way. The opposition now, you know, of course, they're using their bodies to stop the project. And I really think that it has gotten to this level now because TMT and UH are not honoring that this is still in a legal appeal, and they're moving forward. And so, you know, we've begged the question, what happens if you start construction, you start excavating, and then the court finds in our favor, which has happened before? How are you going to restore the damage done? Wouldn't it be better to wait until the appeal is finished and then, you know, can move forward, if so be it? But I think at this point, I don't think that's...
Because we should say that there's an appeal that's in court now.
There is.
Mm-hmm. And who knows what may happen
Correct.
After that. So you're saying the better part of this would be to wait and get a definitive decision rather than to keep moving ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're going to see what happens with it. We have to go for the moment. But Shelley, thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Shelley Munioka is a lifelong resident of Haia, Oahu, and has a master's degree in social work. She's been following the Mauna Kea TMT issue since 2010 when she worked at Kahea as a community educator.
Earth Day is coming up. The official date is next Wednesday, April 22nd, but events to mark the occasion are already getting underway, and Heather Salmon is the priestess of ceremonies for an Earth Day mystic mass dance ritual Saturday in Makoao, Maui. It's described as a dynamic, interactive community ritual with live performances, immersive visuals, prayer, dance, music, indigenous wisdom, and inspiration. And we talked with her about it the other day.
Oh, Lord. I've been involved with Earth Days for many, many years. So it's just been a natural extension of my work as a lover of the planet, as someone who wants to make a difference, as someone who cares. I think the first Earth Day festival I was part of was the San Diego Balboa Park Earth Day Festival. There are two Earth Day celebrations this year, and I'm involved in both of them. The first one is Saturday night, and we have an Earth Day Mystic Mass. It's a multicultural community ritual and dance and celebration of Earth Day that's taking place at Makawao Union Church. And then we have Sunday, the Earth Day Festival, the 18th annual, that we're also playing at. And that's at the Keopulani Park Amphitheater across from the War Memorial Stadium. And it's got a full day of music, two stages, lots of things happening. And so it's going to be very exciting. Some of the best talent. And there's got some workshops and some booths for various nonprofits on the island. So it's going to be a very exciting and full Earth Day festival on Sunday.
Sounds like it. You're having, with the Earth Day Mystic Mass Dance Ritual, Heather, why is ritual important in something like this?
Because ritual helps to bring our community together and vocalize on things that we are wanting to create and perhaps things that we are wanting to transform. So right now, you know, this is a multicultural, non-denominational ritual where our community can come together and really begin to envision those things that we want to bring forth and create for our community. And as we know, one of the big things here on Maui is that we import 90% of our food. So just merely understanding and setting the intention for our community to grow more food can help all of us. First of all, if we just simply grew 10% more of our food, that would inject over $200 million into our economy. So it's just bringing these issues forth and have creating kind of a common understanding within our community and connecting them with the Farmers Union, with Locals for Local Change, and the Pachamama Alliance, Hawaii, all these people who are doing some great work on the ground to help create more awareness and stimulate the will. We need to create the will for this transformation to happen on our island.
Do you think the will is, do you think it's coming? Do you feel the consciousness changing out there in the community?
Yes, I do. I do. And I feel that our community is, you know, somewhat fractured, you know, separated. So There are some people with a lot of the will, like the Farmers Union. Those farmers are doing great stuff. And then there's like more like the everyday person who doesn't know where to start, but could really use a helping hand. So that's why we need to build these bridges now and make connections and mentor and support each other, because the will is there, but some people are lost and they feel intimidated and not know where to start or what to do. So our intention is really to help to create relationships that will foster and assist that transformation at this time.
Because more and more, Heather, I'm seeing changes in consciousness taken directly to the subject of food, how we make it, how we provide ourselves with it. And it really seems as if that whole consciousness change is very much directed toward the whole food issue, which used to be a side issue.
Right. And on Maui, it's very much a forefront issue because it is tied in with our sovereignty. I mean, you know, the Hawaiians are very much wanting to create more sovereignty and kind of decolonize the island somewhat. But to do that, our food issues are, food is one of the most important things. If, as long as we are dependent on multinationals for our food, then we can't have any sovereignty on our island. As long as we're depending on boats and as long as we're depending on, you know, fossil fuels to get us our food here, then we don't have any independence. And we're in trouble because for any reason there was a disaster or something and the ship stopped, then we would be in big trouble on this island. And it's really quite a scary thing, especially in light that this island used to be totally self-sufficient not too long ago.
You use the word decolonize, and you could make an analogy to the world of food where, in a way, food sources have become colonies, yeah? Do people understand that, you know, in a broader sense? I mean, not just people in the movement, but the public at large?
I don't really think so. I think people are, you know, struggling pretty much to make ends meet, and to cost of living is very high, and to feed their families. So it's like there's not a lot of energy and effort put into these ideas and have a greater understanding of what's happening.
Heather Salmon is the priestess of ceremonies for an Earth Day Mystic Mass dance ritual Saturday at the Makawao Union Church Hall. You can learn more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for The Conversation comes from Fran Butera at Foodscapes Hawaii, helping Hawaii residents grow fresh, organic food at their home, school, or business. FoodscapesHawaii.com.
Ulana, umau, ukaholabe, ohavai.
It's HPR lore from the Dark Ages on today's Backyard Quiz. Yesterday, we said that HPR first went on air November 13th, 1981, but we neglected to say where exactly that was. Now, this location is steeped in the stuff of an often told story, so this should be easy if you've been a member for a little while. So can you name the location of the station's first studios and also identify the unusual acoustical material that was prominently featured in those studios? Those humble beginnings 34 years ago still epitomize HPR's ethic to squeeze the most value out of your contributions. And if you think you know the answer, well, wait a little bit and you can check it later this hour when we give that answer to you. The Merchant Marine Act of 1920 has endured for almost a century. And while the Hawaii debate over the law, often referred to as the Jones Act, hasn't raged nearly as long, a devoted group of opponents continues to say that it's costing Hawaii $7.5 million a year. But is it true? Civil Beat had a look, and reporter Chad Blair has today's reality check. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning and happy day two of the pledge drive, Beth Ann.
Well, we'll see how happy it's going to be by the time we're at the end of it, won't we? But for the moment, we're going to be happy that it will hopefully come to a conclusion, and we'll have good things to say when we talk to you tomorrow. But for the moment, let's take a look at the Jones Act. I mean, we've had so many conversations over the years about this. And last year, Senator Hirono kind of got involved with it, too. At this point, do we have any real clarity about how much this is in fact costing or not costing Hawaii?
Well, let me just remind our listeners what the Jones Act does. That means that cargo that is shipped between domestic ports, our ports, be on U.S.-built and owned ships with at least 75% crew. So that means if a container ship comes from South Korea or Japan or China and they go to Long Beach, California, they can't then go to Seattle or Oakland or Anchorage or Honolulu without transferring that cargo to a U.S. ship. And therefore, that's where the cost is coming in here. And so the question has always been this this divide. People like Mazie Hirono say, in fact, it protects jobs. That's why we must have the Jones Act. And then people like Sam Sloan, the Republican in the legislature, or even John McCain in Congress, say, wait a minute, we really should eliminate this. This is protectionism, and it's really driving up prices. So that's the setup of what the Jones Act is. Your question is, what do we really know? I'm just going to cut to the chase. The reality check is there really is no credible objective study about what the Jones Act does in terms of a price tag for our consumer goods here.
But a lot of the numbers that we hear bandied about are coming out of that PricewaterhouseCoopers study that came out, what, 2-3 years ago.
Right, but that was a study that was commissioned on behalf of a maritime interest. And so Carl Bonham, the UH professor, the economist, says, look, there's a lot of wild assumptions out there. You know, is it only $6 per person? Is that what the Jones Act does every year? Or is it more like 6 to 60% price increase? The data is really suspect. And Eric Pape, who's been doing our Living Hawaii series, which we've been talking a lot about here on HBR, says they looked around. He talked to a lot of people, and despite those numbers thrown back and forth, there really isn't a study out there that's credible and objective. And by the way, we sure could use one.
Well, and the point is about considering the source. At this point, it would probably mean that Congress would have to seriously take this up and commission a study, I would imagine.
Wouldn't be a bad idea. The government accounting office might be a good place to start, nonpartisan, objective.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Thanks, Chad. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks, Bethann.
Chad Blair reports on politics for CivilBeat.com.
Support for today's programming comes from the 10th Annual Hawaii Book and Music Festival, celebrating reading, storytelling, and music, May 2nd and 3rd on the grounds of Honolulu Hale. Event schedule online at hawaiibookandmusicfestival.com.
For today's Backyard Quiz, we asked you to name the location of HPR's first studios back in 1981 and to identify the unusual sound-absorbing material those studios sported. Those humble beginnings still epitomize HPR's ethic 34 years later to squeeze the most value out of your contributions. After moving to our current studios on Kaheka Street in 1987, we've made efficient use of our still compact space. As a member, you're welcome to come tour our studios, and if you do, you'll see a framed piece of egg carton, the first material used to dampen sound back in the days when HPR was in the quarry on the UH Manoa campus. Then it was called the Varsity Building. The site is now a parking structure. That's the blast from HPR's past for today, and if you have one, please do send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. People always find a way to make music, crafting instruments out of materials at hand. Drums, stringed instruments, and flutes all have their variants around the world with sonorities unique to their region. This weekend brings a rare opportunity to hear the music of the Himalayas, a part of the world that, despite its remoteness, is rich with cross-cultural influences. Two of the musicians, Anna Sturr and Ram Kumar Singh, are with us this morning, and Anna is going to introduce us to some remarkable music. Good morning, Anna.
Good morning.
How did you get interested in this music?
Oh, it's a very long story, but the short story is that as soon as I got to Nepal, I heard so many different diverse sounds. And so for the last 15, 16 years, I've been trying to make sense of them.
Diverse sounds, in a way, because a lot of different influences are at play, right?
That's true. Yeah, Nepal is incredibly diverse, and there are many, many different ethnic groups and also just different regional musical styles. So the exhibit that we have at the East-West Center right now is called Mountain Minorities, and there are two different ethnic groups that are featured there. So you get to go there and see some of their instruments as well as other aspects of their material culture. And there are videos and audio clips of that, but we play totally different things.
Did you have Western musical training before you took up these instruments?
I did.
So was it a huge stretch, a departure for you?
Perhaps not as big of a stretch as you might think, but the culture of performing was different.
I would imagine.
Yeah, musically, not so different.
Uh-huh. Well, we want to make sure we leave time for a couple of music samples, so let's hear your instrument and Ram's instrument as well. Ram has a wooden flute called what?
It's called bansuri.
And my drum here, it's a double-headed barrel drum called the madal.
Uh-huh. Well, go ahead and play us something.
All right.
That was lovely. Anna, you know, one of the things that strikes me about that music is that the use of the drum as a tonal center, right, as a tonal reference, because really the musical bed was coming from the percussion instrument, right, from the drum.
That's right.
And it sets up a kind of a drone over which he was playing. Was that improvised?
Yes. There's a beat that we're both playing.
Right.
That beat is called Kali. Mm-hmm. And he was improvising on a song.
Uh-huh.
Ram, what's the name of the song that you were playing?
It is Urle Rao Da Gandaki Ko Phelle.
So that means the water of the Gandaki River is rising and swelling.
Well, I know you're going to sing for us, but you need to switch instruments before we do that, right?
That's right, yeah.
So describing your drum, it's about, what, a foot and a half long, fairly narrow, with where you tap at both sides, and you have the two sides of the drums tuned to an octave in this case.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's where the I was surprised when you first played it to hear how resonant the sound was for such a little instrument. I would think it would have to be a big booming drum, but let's hear some singing in that style as well.
Light, 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 light
lari lari la yo jo bantim lai ho sadai bhari lai yo jo bantim lai ho sadai bhari lai.
That was a really lovely melody. You know, I could really hear that melody coming from the flute as well. It's sort of, it's very similar, and in the way you bent some of the pitches as well, right?
Yes, and the way that we play flute in Nepali and other Himalayan music, we have big holes, so we can actually cover the holes with our fingers and bend the pitches.
You kind of let you back off the hole just a little bit, let a little air in.
That's right.
The pitch around.
Mm-hmm. And as you move your finger over the hole, then you get a nice slide.
Get that kind of a little bit of that hand vibrato.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful sound. It's really it's lovely to get a chance to hear that, and it's remarkably accessible to Western ears. I think it would surprise some people how easily you can pick up on the rhythms and the melodies. Thanks so much to both of you for coming in.
Thank you very much. It's really great to be here.
Anna Stir and Ram Kumar Singh. Part of the ensemble that will perform music of the Himalayas Saturday and Sunday at the East-West Center's Emin Center, Jefferson Hall. And you can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page. I love when we have live music in the studio, don't you?
It's one of my favorite things that you bring to us.
Yeah, and I'm always looking for little lessons from, because we've heard music from around the world on the show, and I always pick up a little something I can steal, which is I'm always looking for.
Okay, so what'd you steal today?
Oh, just the whole idea of that a lot of the character of melodies comes from the notes in between the notes on the piano, that the way you slide in and out of a note, it's what gives music a vocal quality.
Is that a little bit about like the negative space that we see in art?
Yeah, come to think of it.
All right, well, thanks for the lesson.
Food for thought.
We'll have more, I'm sure. But for today, we're going to have to say goodbye to you for the moment. And up tomorrow, we're going to have a look at the overview of the education bills that are in conference. We're going to have Hawaii Educational Policy Center Director Jim Sean here, and we'll have a look.
And absurdist theater seems especially suited to the times. We'll talk with a young actor who's performing in Ionesco's The Bald Soprano.
I love that piece. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and that over there is Chris Vandercook. We'll both be back with you tomorrow. Now over to Pledge Central and Wayne Yoshioka.